surpassed the radar at that time. But they were good for if it was limited visibility, they could identify them and cue the visual in. So you'd have more of an audio cue that'd come in and tell you where to look.
Okay.
So they kind of had a purpose for a while. I think they're probably outdated as well. And the third platoon I had was a chem platoon. So I had three Foxes, which are the chemical reconnaissance vehicles.
Okay. And that was all in the 214th Cav Squadron?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. And then after that?
After that, let's see. Then I went down to lovely Fort Huachuca because they wouldn't let me stay in command and because we were preparing for deployment, and they sent me down there. First job I had, spent, I think, 4 or 5 months being the administrator for a human course. So it was a easy job, not very challenging, and I thought it was a waste of manpower, quite honestly. But after that, I switched over and became an instructor and the committee chief for the CABS career course for military intelligence at Fort Huachuca.
What did that really entail?
Mostly instructing, similar to what I did here, only it was more military intelligence-based. Pretty good staff, great people I worked with there.
And that was for the captain's career course?
Yeah, it was more MI-specific as opposed to leadership. Big challenge there was we'd have about 70 students coming in every 4 months, so we had between 140 and 210 students in the course at any one given time.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting where people would come and talk to me about their security clearance, and I'd be like, 210 people, unless they were a troublemaker, or they're always bugging me. I don't remember him. But he wasn't a troublemaker, so probably trustworthy.
Gotcha. And then what, that was around the early 2000s then?
That would have been, nope, I left Korea in 2000.
Okay.
I left Fort Lewis in 2003. And I was in Huachuca from 2003 to 2005.
And what were some of the things that, I guess, you guys taught at the captain's career course? Was it still more of a conventional style of warfare, or was it starting?
Absolutely. It was just starting to transition at that program, that point. And one of the big things we did was we implemented, or developed and implemented, site exploitation. And one of the big assets we had at that point was we had a British officer who brought a lot of experience from dealing with the IRA. So we were able to take his experience to something that we were kind of relearning again in the unconventional warfare. His name was Dusty Miller, if you're interested.
Is he have published a lot of anything published, like books or?
I don't think he's published. He was a major like I was at the time, and only is a major in the. I think
British.
He went up in the British Army.
Mm-hmm.
He went up through, I think, enlisted, warrant, and then commissioned, so he's quite a bit older than us.
Okay.
And had a lot more time in service.
Is the British system a little bit different with the warrant officers then? Is that kind of a step through to get to the
Their warrant officer, from what I understand, is, as I recall, so I could be wrong here, you might have to do some research, but it was almost more like a sergeant major.
Okay.
That's the way he explained it, so.
And then you said that was before you were getting ready to deploy?
No. The deployment part was we were getting ready to deployment when I was in command. I wanted to stay and deploy with my unit.
Oh, okay.
But
they switched you before
the
deployment.
Big Army said, it's time for you to go. You've got 18 months in command.
How long did they deploy after then?
A year later.
Okay.
So there's no way I would have stayed, been able to stay long enough.
And then after that,
after
Huachuca,
I went to Fort Sam Houston. Mm-hmm. And, well, one other thing I'll add there, that was the only time in my career that I was actually assigned to and in my battalion, even though I've been military intelligence for 18 years.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Was that just probably because of your background with infantry and armor? So you kind of had the mix of all things that they could put you more easily in, I guess, the combat arm side?
Okay, here's the part where you can take it for what it's worth, but it's if you come from combat arms background, mm-hmm. and at that time at least, if you were male and in good shape, you're probably pretty much going to be with armor or infantry.
Gotcha. So then at Fort Sam Houston, were you in the S shop there?
Well, originally I was supposed to be in S3, but there was a brigade commander who felt that I was unqualified because I hadn't been to CGSC yet. So consequently, he put one of the captains in there that had just come from the advanced course who I had taught in the position, and I was assigned to R North.
And what's that?
Oh, okay, I'll have to explain that one a little bit. R North is... You remember Katrina?
Mm-hmm.
You remember all the kickback the government got mm-hmm. for being able to provide support? Well, they developed R North, which is the Army component that falls under NORTHCOM. NORTHCOM is responsible pretty much for all of North America, which is Canada, United States, and Mexico, and some of the islands there in the Caribbean. Now, NORTHCOM's mission is kind of twofold. One, homeland defense, which is kind of the internal piece, because we didn't have homeland defense to the extent that we do now back then.
Prior to Katrina.
Right. And they're also responsible for missile defense. You know, mm-hmm. if Russians, Chinese, North Koreans, or somebody going to launch a missile, or if bombers are on, then they are the ones who respond. They have, you know, overarching defense of the United States.
So that was kind of a carryover from the Cold War then?
Yeah.
Okay.
They kind of got twofold. I mean, the original intent was the Cold War. However, since they are also responsible for North America, as we identified through Katrina and the lessons we learned, they had other applicable uses. So, as NORTHCOM being the Army component, given posse comitatus, federal troops can't do a lot of stuff mm-hmm. on the soil of the United States. Our primary mission was responding to natural or man-made disasters. So we had hurricanes, earthquakes, forest fires, pretty much anything that's going to mm-hmm. be like Katrina and cause large amounts of suffering. And so we'd be able to go in, provide, you know, a unit would fall under it just because we were only an Army headquarters. But once we deployed, we would take over the command and control, work with the state or the regional director.
Gotcha.
And be able to utilize, whether it was air power or Hemet's, to get stuff in, because we had the vehicles and equipment that most government agencies don't. So we'd also coordinate with FEMA.
Gotcha. Did you do work with National Guards then, too? Would they kind of augment, or were they separate?
They would be in the deployments we did. But we were a higher headquarters because most National Guard units will usually come in with a brigade, and this is an Army-level headquarters. So we would do a lot of the linking up between the different organizations, FEMA, and we would be providing the assets, command and control. So as they come in, take them, give them directions so you don't just get there and sit around, mm-hmm. which was one of the problems we had with Katrina. Now, when I was there, I was in the plans division as the intelligence planner. So I learned a lot about the higher echelon planning at that point. Being an intelligence officer, it was kind of frustrating because we can't do any collection in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned probably more about the legal aspect of intelligence than anything else. We also did coordination with the JTTF, which is the FBI, local law enforcement, and any other organizations, because they would do all the collection. And we were just really more like monitoring it, because we couldn't do collection, dissemination, or analysis.
Gotcha.
Do a little bit of analysis, but...
So was that more of a operations level then, or was that brigade level? Or
That's Army level.
Okay, that was a whole higher headquarters level.
Yeah.
Okay.
For most things that would happen in the United States, you wouldn't deploy a division. We'd have brigades or battalions fall in under us, as you know, with like task force.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I mentioned all the natural disasters. We'd also train to react to terrorist events.
Hmm.
Both, the big threats we had there was mentioned the natural disasters. You'd have the terrorist threat, and always big fear was they got a hold of nuclear warfare, radioactive, you know, a dirty bomb,
mm-hmm.
and also chemical or biological, as well as back then the bird flu was a big thing, so we had train for how we do various different containments for biological, whether it's natural or a terrorist attack.
And is that unit still around, probably?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's just that's more of the home defense unit of the Army, more of the internal community defense, I guess you could call it. Interesting. I guess I didn't know that you did that.
Yeah, that's... Not very many people realize that it's there.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense that it is, mm-hmm. if you think about it. Cool. And then you were there for 2 years at Houston?
Nope, 1 year. And then I volunteered for a trip to Iraq.
And that was in 2005?
Nope, that would have been January 2007 to April 2008.
What unit were you deployed with there?
MNFI, Multinational Forces, Iraq.
And were you a commander at that point, or was it a SHOP?
I was in the Anti-Terrorism Force Protection Cell for MNFI, which was in control of the entire country of Iraq. Now, my original job there was basically collecting tactics, techniques, and procedures for how they were attacking us. And it was an interesting job. At first, came in, was, you know, all focused around doing the intel stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I quickly learned that the brief that I'd give every 2 weeks to a two-star general that was sitting back at Tampa, he really wasn't concerned with me doing analysis with my cell of one, as much as if I was able to pick an event on a way that the enemy was attacking us and determining how they were emplacing it and doing it in what, so that he could have other smart guys start developing ways to counter it. That's what he was interested in.
Hmm.
So it made my job a whole lot easier, because instead of spending all his time doing analysis that you had, it was somewhat redundant because you had whole teams and cells that were doing the same thing and probably at a far better ability than I had, because
mm-hmm.
they had more resources, assets. And so I focused on that, made my briefs a whole lot easier, because I realized that if I have some pictures and give some analysis on how I thought they were doing it, it would go on. Now, once I had more free time, and you'll find that in the military, it always depends on, you got the guys who are going to carry the load
mm-hmm.
and the guys that are going to kind of hang out on the wayside. My boss started giving me more taskers. So the first one I got was, I was responsible for the security for 62 government of Iraqi ministers. That's kind of like the equivalent to our Congress, you know, so it had the Minister of Defense, Minister of Interior, Minister of Education, and I can't remember all of them, but there were 62 of them. So I'd coordinate with them if they had security issues. Primarily, I would be issuing them arms, as well as getting their personal security detachments trained, so the coordination was more like an S3. Not planning operations, but planning training for those individuals. It was pretty interesting. Had to do a lot of changes, because when I first took over that job, the guy I took over for was pretty much certifiably crazy.
Hmm.
And by that, I mean literally. He was on antidepressant drugs. I think he was on his third tour because he had marital problems. He had gotten a DUI in country, so he couldn't carry a sidearm.
In Iraq? I guess I didn't even realize that alcohol was permitted.
It's not. That's why he, between the alcohol and the antidepressants, is why he couldn't carry a sidearm. But I would tool around the green zone with him. And the only armament we'd have would basically be my 9mm. So, but the way he conducted business was not in the way I was brought up. You know, the first time he wanted to transfer the weapons, which were AK-47s and Glock 9mm, to the security team that we were going to get coordinated with, it's like, yeah, we drive outside the green zone, they pull up next to us, and we shuffle them from our trunk to their trunk. And I said, whoa, 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 whoa.
That sounds like
that's not how we're doing it. Which was kind of hard because he outranked me, but I was able to win him over one way or another. So then we started implementing that they would come in the green zone, we would teach them the proper accountability. So instead of it, just here's a bunch of guns, goodbye, I would get a picture of them, go through serial numbers for every weapon so they understood that they were responsible for them and what we expected, so that they couldn't come back the next month and say, no, you never gave me any. And I'd be like, hey, here's my picture of you smiling with 12 AK-47s and 5 9mm.
And that was for the Iraqi security forces or the Iraqi National Army that you were working with mostly?
No, that was the private security companies.
Private security.
Because at that time...
Oh, okay, the American private.
No, they were Iraqis.
Iraqi.
But okay. Basically, as if you were the minister of whatever, you would usually hire a bunch of relatives or friends that you trusted to be your security detail. And so then we would be ensuring that they got trained up so that they understood the basic concepts of how you protect an individual, what you look for.
Gotcha. And would they mirror with, like, entire like platoon size elements of American forces, or was it mostly just your unit advising?
Well, like I said, I had 62 of them, so we didn't advise them. We got them the training, which was done through a private security company.
Okay.
But they, depending on how familiar you are with it, the size of it really depended on how rich you were and how powerful a position you were.
Okay.
Some of the guys I dealt with would have 60-man private security companies or private security details. Others would have 12 to 15.
So you had to kind of coordinate amongst the different, I guess, the officials and figure out how you were going to train them based on
right.
the numbers. So is that one of the more difficult things to do, was to tailor to the size?
No, because I had directions on how much I could give them. So once they were ready to accept them or they identified the people they wanted for training, then I'd coordinate the training. And sometimes if they were rich enough, they wouldn't want it, but usually... because I was primarily responsible for issuing vehicles which were up-armored Suburbans, or I can't remember what the other vehicle we had that was up-armored, but they were all civilian vehicles, and issuing the weapons. So whenever you have anything that they want, they would come see me.
And this was in Baghdad? It was where you were
yes.
where you were deployed? Okay.
Baghdad in the Green Zone, which was... my office was actually in the embassy.
Oh, okay. And the Green Zone, I know I've seen a map of the city before.
Mm-hmm.
That was on the western border? Is that kind of where
it's
it was?
It's just west of the river.
Of the river, yeah. That's what I meant by the river yeah. that runs to the middle of the city. And then what was to the east of it? That was that the Blue Zone? Is that what it was called?
I can remember the streets, and I can remember the map of... I never heard it called the Blue Zone.
Okay, I might be thinking of something.
But if
different.
You go farther east, then you would hit, which is Sadr City.
Mm-hmm. And that was where one of the, that was that, were you there during the, I guess you were right after the surge then?
Surge happened when I originally got there. General Casey was in charge. I don't remember how long he was there, 3 or 4 months. And then General Petraeus came in, and then we started the surge. which is why it turned into a 15-month deployment instead of 12.
And what unit were you technically deployed within?
It was just fall under MNFI.
Okay. Now, one of the things I'm kind of researching is how, I guess, command shift different, had not just the top general, but different, I guess, operational leadership, the changing in and out, how that affected the overall war. Was there a fairly significant difference that you could see between General Casey's leadership and General Petraeus' leadership?
Yes.
Okay.
General Casey was more reserved. He didn't ask as many questions. And I never dealt directly with him, but we would listen to the briefs every day, or every other day, I can't remember. I think it was every other day at the time. And when General Petraeus came in, he, quite honestly, he knew his shit. He would come in, if the power line was down, he'd be like, "Hey, that power line's been down for 3 weeks now. Why isn't it up?" And we'd hear why, and he's like, "Okay, get it up. Whatever it takes to get that so that this city can start getting electricity, you need to make them happen." A lot of it was difficult because we didn't have troops who would be putting up power lines, but we'd have to get the Iraqis to secure the engineers or the maintenance people to do it.
So you were there, then it would have been a whole year that he came in April of that year, right? Your first year in there, April or June?
That sounds about right.
Yeah, so you had almost a full year. Mm-hmm. The last full year of your deployment was under General Petraeus.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, do you know how many troops about were in Baghdad at the time?
No. I could pull a number, but it would, no.
Okay.
If you ask me closer to coming out, I might be able to give you a better answer, but at this point, no.
I'm sure I can research that and figure it out.
What I can tell you is I can remember back then we would consider it a good day if on the SIGAX report, if we had fatalities that were single digits and casualties under 60. Because during the surge, the casualties we took were pretty heavy.
I know that it was more of a block to block, basically clearing of the entire eastern part of the city, right? During the surge, with Sadr City, because that was one of the hotter areas.
Each area differed, because I don't know how familiar you are, but you had the basically broken down on religious lines, the Sunni and the Shia. And at that time, the Sunnis were doing a lot more terrorist tactics, and as you know now, eventually fed into ISIS. They were armed pretty well, but they didn't have the numbers or political might that the Shia did. So when I was dealing with those government officials that I was telling you about, I'd talk to them, and basically they would have 4 or 5 different driver's licenses depending on what area of town they were going to go into, whether you needed a Shia name or a Sunni name. And that was common practice for them, because if you went into some areas, even if you were at a military or police checkpoint, you might not come home if you don't have the right name. That time, the big threat we had was the Mahdi militia, or the Shia factions, were using EFMPs, which is explosively formed projectiles. And they were able to defeat most armor defenses that we had at the time.
That was the Sunni militia?
Shia.
Shia militia. Okay.
Only the Shia had the EFMPs because, I can't tell you why because I'm not sure the classification. But it needed resources that you could only get from Iran. They couldn't be produced in Iraq at that time. So whenever we saw those, we knew who it was that was doing it. The Sunnis were doing more of the car bombs, explosions. And suicide vests.
What were, I guess, some of the developments that you saw in the types of, I guess, weapons they employed? Like, did you see a significant difference in how they were dressed? Because I know that at the beginning, a lot of times the suicide bombers would be in all white until that was kind of caught on to. How was the evolution of the tactics developed?
Once we would catch on to something, they would do something else, and they did everything from having a man dress up like a pregnant woman. If there was a carcass on the road, put the IEDs inside the carcass. There was one, we kind of joke because you've heard of BBIEDs. We had a DBIED, which was a donkey-born IED.
I think I have heard that before.
Downside for them was the donkey wouldn't go where they wanted it to. They'd do all kinds of different techniques. They had these anti-armor hand grenades that you could throw over a wall so you couldn't see the person throwing it. And then they were at a large magnet in it. They would direct it towards the vehicle. Once it got close enough, it would detonate.
That was a magnetic IED?
Yeah. Tough thing about that one is it's being thrown over, and the least armament you have is on top. So, actually, that wasn't an IED because it wasn't improvised. Yeah. It was just a munitions.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that's something that probably only would develop in urban warfare versus a rural.
Right.
Is that, do you know if that's still a prevalent type of weapon used? Or did the U.S. kind of up on
They were hard to get a hold of because I think the ones that we saw were Russian made, and I think they were held over. They weren't being imported.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just my speculation. So I think basically they ran out of them, or they weren't successful enough, because you don't toss it at the right time, you're just going to miss.
That makes sense. I guess overall climate in the year that you were there, was there an overall shift from, I guess, the American feeling on how it was going in Baghdad from when you got there towards the end? Was it a positive thought that it was improving?
The surge definitely had a positive effect, I think, because while we had more casualties and that was harder, felt like there was more being accomplished, and we started having more faith in the Iraqi forces.
Do you think there was a mutual development that the Iraqis started to trust the American side more since there were more troops too? I guess it was it seemed more of a legitimate force.
It depends on which ones you dealt with, because I did do some things with the Kurds, and they had a very disciplined military force, which the press loves them here, and you can see all kinds of stuff about that. They're not supermen. They're not these great fighters. They just train their soldiers, and they had a more militaristic sense to them, as opposed to, I'm going to promote this guy because he's related to me. The biggest problem was the government was all done on religious lines. And as you know through history, that led to the birth of ISIS, but they were much more tied to the religion and their clans or tribes, I guess, than they were to the success of the government. It was a little bit of what can I get out of it, as well as how can I get more power so that maybe someday I can seek retribution.
And that was from both the Sunni and the Shia factions, or was that just who was in power at the time?
Nope, the Sunnis were in power, and it was mostly from them. The Shia were trying to figure out how they're going to survive. No, like I said, though, I'm dealing with government representatives, not terrorists.
Was there any sense of, I guess, development, I guess, any of your time in Iraq at all, that the Sunni and Shia did start to work with each other?
No.
It's still just, it was just, the entire time it was very bipolarized. And I know that has a long historical, going back a long ways, because the Ba'ath Party was Shia.
No.
They were Sunni. And then did it shift over to a Shia leadership for a while, and then it shifted back?
No.
It was just Sunni the whole time?
Saddam was a Sunni, and they were the minorities. But they held the guns and the power up until we came in. Once we threw Saddam out, then a Shia government came to power, and they're still in power.
And they have a and the population split in Iraq is about 2/3 to 1/3, I guess, between those two sects. Is that
pretty close to that?
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add about, I guess, that stint in Iraq?
Next tasker I got was, if you're familiar with the Nansouer Square shooting.
I've heard of it. I'm not sure in the details.
Where Blackwater, if you remember that name, shot, I think it was about 14 or 16 civilians right outside the Green Zone. And it created a huge political bog for us. I was tasked to be General Barbero's personal aide for the investigation. So it was kind of interesting because I was able to sit there and see our ambassador talk to the president of Iraq and all these meetings on the investigation were going. I think we pretty much slow rolled, and I think it was within the last year that we actually came out with the findings of that investigation that happened in 2007. And once he knew me, then I got the tasker of being developed, because what we realized there was we had all these private security companies running around that worked for DOD, different contracting companies, Department of State, and other governmental agencies, but no way to really track them, who's where and who's doing what, or any constraints on telling them what they can and can't do. So I was put in charge of developing an op order that kind of pulled them all together so that we had one overarching headquarters that was able to monitor them so we'd know where any of them were moving at one time. So if somebody said there was an incident with a convoy, we'd know which company that was, what they did, and where they were. And that was very painful, but interesting. Learned a lot of legal there. Worked with a great Air Force colonel, great JAG colonel. It really helped me out a lot. Next big thing I did in Iraq was Vice President Cheney was coming, and he was going to do the first ground movement of VIP in Iraq. So he's going from the Green Zone to Sistani's. I can't remember his actual title, but he was a big religious and political figure. I think he was Shia, but I'm not pretty sure he was.
What was it, that name?
Sistani.
Okay.
And we'll divert here, and this will be just a little bit more of boasting in old soldiers' war stories. But that one was real interesting because I just happened to be walking in the hall in the embassy, and one of the guys that was responsible for the security of the actual Green Zone goes, "Hey, we're having a meeting this afternoon. I think maybe you should come." You know, and we didn't know who was coming or what, but when you start seeing all the guys in the Secret Service or uniform, so you can pick them out. So we're like, okay, we don't know who's coming. But then I found out, and I met with the Secret Service. Great individuals to work with. Love that mission. So they told us that the VP is coming, and we need to set up the security for it. And I go into the meeting with him, and I'm sitting there, and I'm watching the State Department, who I don't have so many nice things to say about. But they go on, and they start this meeting. And first of all, this is a security meeting, and we have probably 60 people crammed into this room. And they're talking about where Mrs. Cheney's going to go to the bathroom and what she's going to do in her downtime and stuff that I thought was all protocol. And so I look over, I'm sitting next to the Secret Service guy. I said, I thought this was a security meeting. He's like, you can kind of start and see, you know, the blood rush into his face, and he's getting pissed. So finally he gets up and goes, okay, anybody who's not directly involved with the security, leave now. We'll have a protocol meeting with somebody else later, and you can figure all that out. Mm-hmm. So they got up and left, and so then we're down to about 15, 20 people. The State Department gets up and goes, here's what we're going to do, and here's how we're going to do it. Here again, I leaned over to him, and I said, I thought you're in charge. He goes, okay. So wrapped up the meeting, and he comes back to me, and he says, can you get me everything I need? I said, what do you need? I can get you troops. I can do the coordination for all the security for the soldiers that were going to secure the route. That would then trickle down to securing our coordination with the Iraqis and their military. But I don't have vehicles that are suitable for the prestige and level of the personnel that you're bringing in. There's no problem. We'll task State Department for that, and drivers too. So did all that, planned it out, went off without a hitch, and the day of the mission, he comes down and goes, all right, maybe it was the day before. What are you going to be doing? I said, well, I'll be sitting back here in the talk watching you guys on a UAV. He goes, well, that sounds like it sucks and probably be really boring. I'm like, yeah, it will be. He goes, okay, well, since we've worked with you, would you mind taking over Crisis Action Team 2? So then I took over a platoon that was from the Massachusetts National Guard, and we followed right behind the convoy, and we did some rehearsals, but basically our mission was if they did have anything go bad while we're on the road or while they're in the building, mm-hmm. we were to come up and secure the perimeter around the Secret Service, pretty much shoot anybody that wasn't them. Mm-hmm. And it was real interesting. Great mission. I spent the day on the road with those boys from the Guard. And I remember one of them, actually, his wife gave birth that day, and he found out when we're on mission.
Oh, well, that's kind of neat.
Yeah, I kept in touch with them for a while. They're good guys.
That's really interesting. I guess how many people, I guess, would be involved with an out-of-country? Like, how many people, Secret Service agents type thing? Was it like a couple hundred people?
Secret Service? No. Secret Service is real small detachment. Basically, they had the people who would secure the individual, mm-hmm. and then they had small, slightly bigger than a squad that would be securing the close area, who they had doing the sniper overwatch and stuff like that. I didn't have this ability on, but we pretty much in line the entire route with U.S. and Iraqi forces.
Okay.
Wherever there was an Iraqi force, there was also a partnered U.S. force.
Mm-hmm. I guess leading into something else, the partnered forces, was there any development while you were there? Was there any sort of like tactical shift with that? I guess I don't know if they became more of effective over time type thing. If there was some, I know that sometimes there's friction between different nations trying to work together and advise in-nation units.
I didn't see as much of that.
Okay.
At the level I was at.
Gotcha.
So I can talk more about that in Afghanistan.
Okay. And I guess we'll get to that a little later. Cool. Anything else in Iraq?
Nope. I think that covers most of it.
Okay, that's perfect. So then after April 2007, you got back
mm-hmm.
from deployment, and what was your assignment after that?
Went back, basically picked up my family at Fort Sam Houston and went to CGSC and spent a year there for the Command General Staff College.
Okay.
And spent that year, completed the course, got my master's at the same time. Coming out of that, at that point we were still doing a lot of deployments. So all the jobs we had, you're going to be going back overseas within the next 8 months or so. So I volunteered to go on a MID team, which is mobile training team, which later transitioned into what we called an SFAT, which was a security force and assistance training team. I fell under First Brigade, 4th Airborne Battalion. So it was with the 82nd. Initially, we were on the training team mission. Great boss. We were going to come in and we're going to counter or partner up with an Afghani brigade. It was 2nd Brigade of the 205th Infantry, Afghani Army. That was a real interesting mission. My starting assignment, or I'm trying to figure out how to word this, but I was the executive officer because I had a lieutenant colonel in charge. Then there was me as a military intelligence major. He was infantry. Then we had a captain that was our SIGO. We had a captain that was going to do the logistics mentoring.
SIGO.
Signal. Communications. Okay. We had a captain that was supposed to partner up with the S3. Then we had a fires NCO. And one other NCO, I can't remember what he was. Once we got into theater, we had a couple civilians that would kind of help the captain on logistics as well as personnel.
So it was a very diverse... diverse battalion. And was that,
I guess, that's not a battalion, that's just a team.
Oh, okay.
I mean, counted up, we had our highest strength was 12.
Oh, okay. That was for your training assistance team.
Right.
Okay.
We also had NRAO at that time.
Which is?
What years?
NRAO.
Was this? It was in Zabul.
Okay.
Headquarters was in Kalat. Zabul is a province. Kalat was the city. Can we take a break here so I can
For sure.
Some more money in the... where'd we leave off?
We left off right after Zabul and Kalat.
Okay.
We're starting to get into that, so the start of...
The structure we had there was 4th Brigade, 82nd Airborne. Was overall responsible for AAB, Assistance and Something Brigade. So our mission, the brigade mission, was to have all these SFAT teams to go out. Along with the SFAT teams, you would have the battalions in various areas. The battalion that we worked with was 1st of the 508th Infantry, 82nd Airborne. So that battalion was in the same area that our SFAT team was. While our team was mentoring the brigade staff, that battalion then had platoons out at each company's post. You got something I can write on?
Yeah, let's...
draw you a quick sketch of what the AO looked like. So that was not very good. You can look at a map and see what Zabul looks like. Pretty much you had Highway 1, which Kandahar was down here, and the capital was up here. And then Highway 1 had a big circle that had a ring route all the way throughout the country. This was the road that connected Kandahar and Kabul. Basically, we had mountains all the way here, and all the way down here. Now we had a FOB up here, one right here, one here, here, here. That was Shijoy. I can't remember what that other little one's name was. That was Mizon. One there. That was a road. Came up in here. Travel on here, we could do. There was a Romanian battalion. When before I left, it became two battalions. It was primarily secure for, or responsible for securing Highway 1. That created some difficulties.
Just the international?
Yeah.
Working multinational.
Came here. Now, if you look at the map, we could basically travel to this one easy, and this one, and this one. All these other ones, you had, but this would be a company level. Where's the other guy? I think he was here. Yeah. That would be a company level.
Okay, I'm just going to mark that here.
You need to go over your doctrinal terms and signals.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to probably submit this one with everything else so that if someone else needs to use it, they can interpret it as well.
And then, so all these would be platoons. So, the only one we could get to is we could get to this one and this one without very much difficulty. You can make that drive easy. Let's see. That's where battalion headquarters was. There was another one over here that had an SF group, and it was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was only about... You could almost drive a golf ball to it, but because you'd have to go down into the city and around, you couldn't really walk because it was only a couple kilometers away.
How big was that SF attachment? Is that something you could talk about? Or
they had some support. I don't know what size. And there was one team. When we were there, it was a SEAL team. And they would be operating, doing different things. We would do pretty good intelligence sharing with them. We'd meet with them about every other week.
But they're kind of... They're almost more independent.
Yeah, they had their own mission. Now, the SVATs, or the AAB I was telling you about, we were headquarters here in Kalat. Our mission was to partner with the Afghanis and train them. When I first got there, there was a striker battalion over here, and this is where the airfield was, at least for helicopters. And they were supposed to be doing the more... Without better term comes to mind right now, the hunter killer. They're supposed to be finding bad guys and neutralizing.
Because they're the mechanized capabilities, strikers. Yeah.
Yeah, but strikers didn't fare so well with IEDs. So we each had our own separate mission. Now, the initial problem you can see is you got two battalion commanders operating in the same battle space. That created headaches.
And there's nothing else in the...
Right. Now, the reason I drew the picture was, in order for us to get to this company headquarters, well, it was actually a company, it would take basically a battalion mission. We'd have to get the engineer assets from brigade or higher to do it, and pretty much from the time we left here, you knew you're going to be getting IEDs. If we went to this battalion headquarters, it'd be the same thing. If we ever went out for any major resupplies to any of these platoons, it was going to be a battalion mission because, so we'd only do it once every 6 months.
Really? Would they get resupplies by air then a lot?
Yeah. Now, this one we never could get to by ground because it was too far away, the road was too rough, and
just mine to help.
It wouldn't be worth, yeah. And it was way up in the mountains. But you being a soon-to-be lieutenant, you think about that. You're off in some of these places, and you're the man. You're not going to see your boss, but maybe once a month, once every other month, because the only way you can get in there is by flying in.
Mm-hmm. And that brings a lot of attention when you fly something in, because that's a $660 million piece of equipment flying overhead.
It wasn't too bad. We didn't lose any helicopters when we were there.
It was more just the route getting in, getting out.
But, you know, you do your things. They were responsible for doing patrols, as we know, ambushes, but mm-hmm. we saw very little activity, as well as training the Afghan forces. Living conditions there were horrible. It took us almost a year to get them showers. You had internet access, so forth. That kind of gives you an idea of what our AO looked like. Now, as I mentioned, my SFAT team, they deployed off and they were going to take over a specialized police battalion, train them up, and take them down to Helmand Province. I was left behind. Shortly after that, the strikers also were repositioned, so then it was just our infantry battalion minus, because we had two infantry companies, an artillery company, and HHT. We also had another company with the S3 at the time stationed up in Aruzgan, which was a whole nother AO. I think he worked with the Dutch. Mentioned the Romanians were there, and we had an Afghan brigade here. While I was in country, I guess actually before my team left, our captain, who was supposed to be mentoring the S3, was fired. So then I then picked up the duties of the executive officer, the mentoring the S2, the brigade XO, and the S3. When I first got there, my counterpart was an Afghani major. He was their S2. Nothing but great things to say about this guy. Fantastic. He then went back to Kandahar, but a couple months later came back and was promoted to lieutenant colonel and became the S3. Continued working with him. Like I said, in a perfect world, he would have had a political office. Now, some of the cultural aspects is, I don't understand it fully, but the way it was his last name is Saeed. Saeed, at least in Afghanistan and possibly the Muslim world at all, is known more as a counselor. So if you've ever seen The Godfather,
mm-hmm.
you know, Robert Duvall's character,
mm-hmm.
he's the counselor. You know he's never going to go to power, but they listen to him. That's kind of the way I personally interpreted the Saeed. They were never going to give him any command authority, but...
Even though he probably deserved it.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is he told me he couldn't afford to be higher ranked, because in order to get promoted, you had to grease the palms of some people.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the funny things that would go on is the brigade commander that I dealt with a lot, he was a 2-star.
Of a brigade?
Of a brigade. The corps commander was a 1-star. They didn't have division level, so it just went from brigade to corps.
Yeah. So then how many corps would generally be under a... Or how many brigades would be under a corps on an Afghani counterpart? Probably like 8 to 10? Okay. Probably that just varied.
That's probably a decent guess, but...
And that's just because of the wealth associated with having to get up?
The wealth and name reference. The guy that I dealt with supposedly was on the security detail for Massoud. Remember the guy that bin Laden killed before he did 9/11?
Mm-hmm.
So he had well-known name within Afghanistan, and that's probably partially how he got there as well. You know, some of the, back to the war stories, is I would talk with him, you know, and I'd be trying to get him to support missions that we wanted to do. You know, had to get buy-in. Mm-hmm. He'd always be like, I need. You know, at first it was boots and Gore-Tex jackets, and we got those. Then it was nods. You know, and at one point, you know, I'm getting kind of frustrated, I'm looking at him like, you fought with Massoud. You fought the Russians. Did you have nods then? I mean, no.
So yeah, it got to the point where you kind of have to stop the gravy train and try to...
Well, this goes back to what I was talking to you is, we show them how we fight,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to replicate that, but they didn't have the knowledge base or the assets to do it. They couldn't maintain their vehicles. That was all relied on private companies, mostly from third world countries, that would do all the maintenance. If you don't maintain your own vehicle, it's kind of like when you get a rental car. Mm-hmm. You treat it like shit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd be watching these drivers hitting three gears in about a 40-meter space and then slamming on the brakes when they hit a speed bump. Is that how you drive your car?
Mm-mm.
No.
Yeah, I drive a manual.
But if you don't have to do the maintenance, why not?
Okay. I guess that's almost kind of an unsolvable issue in some way, too. It's a difficult problem to solve.
Right. But, you know, you see that wherever you go. I mean, same thing when I was a lieutenant, I was at the advanced course, and we'd have Saudis come in. They would leave during maintenance day and say, no, we hire somebody to do that. You know, and we're talking about changing track, which you never know when the track's going to go down.
Yeah, something you want to fix
right away, and you're going to do it. You're not going to wait for the BSB or maintenance or somebody who's subservient to you, because this is beneath you if you need to get the mission done. I'm not sure where you want to go, which direction, but like I said, the strikers, they left. So then we were responsible for the whole AO. We still had the SEAL team there, but they were kind of doing off their own mission. The other thing that happened while I was there was a buddy of mine that I commanded with when I was at Fort Lewis came in, and he was supposed to be the S3 for our battalion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, due to some personal conflicts between the battalion commander and the brigade commander, the battalion commander was somewhat paranoid of the brigade commander and felt that this guy was a spy. Spy of what? I couldn't tell you. But he was definitely a competent and capable of doing the position, and quite honestly, far more capable than I, as he was armor, I'm military intelligence. Mm-hmm. But due to the personality conflicts, he got fired. And back to the war story part of this, was the way we found out about that is I'm in charge of the med team and I'm doing that, and we'd have meetings, I think every Thursdays, with the boss at about 9 o'clock at night. And my roommate, the XO, Reggie Jeans, is, yep, okay, sir, you know, Al's going tomorrow. He's going to be heading up, pick up that battalion in Kabul, train him up, move him down to Kandahar. And the boss looks at him and goes, what do you mean? When do we discuss this? He's not going anywhere. And we're like, okay, my job is the training team. Taskers for a field grade. There's only three of us.
Mm-hmm.
The XO, the S3, and myself in charge of the training team, so it just made the most sense. Mm-hmm. I would hand off the partnership duties over to the XO and the S3.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he went ballistic. Told the S3 to pack his bags because he's getting on the helicopter tomorrow and go. Once he did that, he never came back, and I took over the position of the S3. So then I had the mentorship of those individuals I told you earlier, as well as planning and coordinating all the missions throughout our AO.
Just because of personal strife above.
Yeah.
And I guess that probably inhibited your ability to, I guess, facilitate with other brigades or other battalions as well in your brigade. Did that cause some strife?
No, I was at battalion level.
Yeah, and did you guys work a lot with adjacent units, adjacent battalions, yeah, things like that? You're pretty much on your...
We're pretty much isolated. And being an MI officer and some tactical background, it was a challenge, and, you know, I got through it largely because I had a couple great captains that really helped me out on the planning and the coordination, because, you know, we were conducting air assaults out here and all over the place, and several missions where we had cordon off an area and go in and search different things, and that was kind of at the knock and ask permission to come in phase. They weren't highly aggressive. Over the years there, if you were going to do a body count by old standards, it would have been considered unsuccessful. The good thing about it was I found out later after I redeployed that this was the first brigade to start conducting missions with without U.S. support.
Hmm. Right after you, or when you were there?
No, this was after I left.
Right after you left, okay. And that took a few years of training of the Afghani forces to get them to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But they were actually able to do it and conduct it effectively?
I think so. I wasn't there to see it, but we had, you know, it's so much personality driven.
Mm-hmm.
We had one battalion commander that was fantastic. You know, was good friends with him and have all the confidence in the world that he'd be able to do it. Then there was other ones that were more interested in collecting tolls at the checkpoints. You know, my impression of Afghanistan was kind of like The Sopranos. As long as the envelope's full, do what you need to do. As long as I get my cut. And, you know, we had a couple investigations. I think the police chief was fired or reassigned as well. But the cultural experiences are different. Like I told you, the battalion commander that I liked and got along with.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting in his hooch one time and I was talking with him. And this was a time when I think our mission was secure all the polling places because we had just had an election. And then the culture in that country was they'd have what we called the chai boy. It was kind of like a manservant for senior ranking people. This guy was responsible for washing his uniform, getting his food, shining his boots, and also making chai, which is why we called him the chai boy. And we're sitting there talking. I was interested, so I asked this young man, he's probably about 17 or 18,
mm-hmm.
What'd you think about the elections? And he said, I don't know. I said, no. Tell me, what'd you think about the elections, you know? Did you favor? Did you, you know, like the part that you had of a voice
mm-hmm.
in your country's future? He said, I don't know. And then finally the battalion commander looks over and goes, who cares what he thinks? The only thing he needs to worry about is getting me my chai and making sure my boots are shined.
And that was the one that you were friends with?
But it was kind of discouraging when we think we're bringing in democracy and all of the lofty goals we had
mm-hmm.
and seeing that what reality was.
Seeing some of the positive effects and then realizing there's still the disconnect between.
Yeah. And dealing with that culture was real interesting because I talked a little bit about the tribal or ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever the brigade commander would introduce me to somebody, he'd be like, oh, he's a good soldier, he's a Zari, which was the same thing he was.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it wasn't Azari because they didn't favor the Azaris very well. I can't remember. But if you're from the same tribe, then he was a great leader. If it wasn't, the introduction would be a lot calmer. And you could just tell.
And that obviously dates back previous to the U.S. involvement there. Quite a ways, generational, probably. Mm-hmm. Even longer than that, maybe even.
I think it goes
centuries.
Like I said, in the Iraq part, it goes back to who your ties are and where your loyalty is. Do you have faith in your country, or do you want your close friends and relatives to profit?
How hard do you think it was for American forces to realize that? Do you think that, I guess, the general, soldier, junior officer, tactical level operations, do you think that they had more of the sense, we're going to go in, give them democracy like what we have back home, and had that type of, you know, realization moment, or most of them kind of get, you know, this is just how it is, and it's going to be hard to really adjust the culture of the country?
Just my opinion, but I think we were a little naive. We thought that because we like it and it works for us and we wanted it, that everybody should like it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something you can change over one generation or in a 12-month deployment.
Mm-hmm. Something that takes half a century or more to...
If it can be changed, yes. Can it? I don't know.
I guess that claim can maybe be replicated not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but other U.S. intervention around the world. I guess we're just historically superpowers around the world, going back to colonialism and things like that.
Going to Africa and you could run into the same problems.
Mm-hmm.
But it was difficult.
And I guess, is there any sort of open dialogue when the instance of the battalion commander talking about his assistant and, you know, that level of, I guess, difference of value of human life, I guess you could kind of say, or how you treat people. Was there any open rhetoric about that you could have with him, or was it just too hard to culture?
No, I could talk to him, and mm-hmm. we were very even and open. I didn't deal with him as much as I dealt with the S2 and S3 that I told you about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But you could kind of see that you weren't going to change it. I mean, I'll call it, you know, racism for lack of a better term, but there was just people in the culture that were going to be at this level, and they weren't ever going to get higher or lower.
More of a case system.
Yes. And, you know, everybody had their purpose, but it's not quite the way we envision it,
mm-hmm.
or at least we profess to. Now, the S2, S3 I told you about, he was a very Western thinker. Quite honestly, I think he was somewhat trained by the Russians when they were still there, but he would never admit to it,
mm-hmm.
because that would also hurt his future. But he was a Western thinker, and he understood it, and he was not afraid to roll up his sleeves and work, which was usually very difficult.
Hmm.
And I guess sometimes you got to look at victory as small steps.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say one of the victories I felt that I had there was on this stretch, we'd have one piece of Highway 1 here, where we were getting a lot of IEDs. So my boss decided we're going to put a FOB up here on this mountain. And there's several parts of this mission that are interesting. But one is, I would look at it and pretty much call out, want something like this. You can pretty much spell it any way you want, but I'll tell you another story about that. But so we wanted to put up a platoon-sized FOB here, and we're going to man it with scouts and an Afghani platoon. Now, at first, we looked at it, you know, we did our map reconnaissance, and we figured the best way to get there is build a road through here. So we went and we talked to the farmers, and you would look at this land and know what your major is, so you'd have some idea, and you'd say, you can't grow nothing but rocks here. Because we're talking about a high plains desert.
Yeah.
Rains a little bit in the winter and the spring, and that's about it. So I didn't know how the kid had got anything to grow there, but he's a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And we had wanted to do this one road, which would have crossed, I can't remember the name of the river. Basically, there's a river that ran along Highway 1. By river, I mean,
it was wet sometime in the year when it would rain?
Yeah, the rest of the time it was a large wadi, and when we'd get the spring rains, it would flood.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have a wadi, and we could have easily, you know, created a ford there, dropped some rocks so that we could maintain it and get there, and it would have been about 2, maybe 3 kilometers from Highway 1 up to this location. The people who owned the land wanted $1.7 million for about 3 kilometers the width of a road.
Worth of gravel.
Tried explaining to them, you know, how it's going to save them, because actually the road from here to the city was more difficult and frequently IED'd as well. They usually didn't hit the IEDs, and you can speculate to why they didn't. But so if you're trying to explain to somebody this is an investment for them so they can get their kids to school, so they can get their crops to the city far easier and far safer,
mm-hmm.
and is all they're looking at as $1.7 million. Basically, I'm not sure, but I think the brigade commander strong-armed him and ended up letting us do it for $10,000. But the big victory we had there was the deal we had for with the Afghani brigade was, if we're going to put troops up there, we'll supply the food, they supply the water, because they had big water trucks, and they also had the big excavator thing that never moved up until this mission. And then, you know, finally got it up and moving, and they drove it all the way up there. But it was always difficult, because when it came to resupplying, they'd be like, oh, they need water. I'm like, okay, remember our deal. I provide the MREs and food, you provide the water, so you need to do a brigade planning mission to get the water truck up there. And the answer was, but it's easier for you to fly it up. You know, and it was really difficult for me to look at them and go, yes, it's easier for you if I do that, but it's not easier for me.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the culture we had where, well, why would I want to take the risk and do a ground movement when you can just get a helicopter and fly it? Now, we don't have helicopters directly under my tasking control. We had to request those from higher, mm-hmm. so it wasn't easy.
Yeah, but they probably had a hard time understanding that.
Right. So getting them to do that mission was a success, one, because they actually used some of the engineer equipment that they had instead of just keeping it in the motor pool where they could show it off. And
it didn't break?
They got it up there because it was up on a high plateau. So I was just happy for that because, you know, I had to do all the sandbags and I forget the HESCO barriers.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. I guess you said earlier when you were towards the end of it, you were one of three left over when the rest of your unit kind of...
Yeah, that's when I fell under 1508.
Okay.
Under the battalion.
Was that more of like a continuity, changing over to a new command? Or a new set of...
That's because my team left and they wanted a field grade officer to maintain the continuity of the partnership with the senior brigade staff.
Okay. So did no one came in to fill the rest of your team that went out? Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Do you, I guess, can you comment at all on some of the difficulties of shifting command from different tactical level units? I guess, does it, the type of friction that it causes between the native population and the American forces there?
Well, that unit was already there. It was just that mine left.
Mm-hmm.
The real issues we had there was... When my original SFAT team was there, the commander had a one-on-one relationship with him,
mm-hmm.
and he was far more reactive. When they left and the 1508's battalion commander took over that role, he was responsible for the entire battle space and running a battalion, plus another company that was detached.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have the time or mentorship, and that's kind of where I picked it up. So then I picked up the brigade commander as well. But brigade commander felt slighted when he should have a lieutenant colonel as opposed to a major. Now, fortunately, by that point, I had built up a relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's where you hear about all your cultural understanding classes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of different when the other person I had a good relationship was the brigade XO. Yeah. The guy had a mustache like Saddam. But when you're walking around, he's showing me walking around the FOB, checking out security and looking at some stuff. And he holds your hand. It's kind of like holding your hand with your grandpa. You do it when you're six, but you don't really do it when you're a man. And my boss enjoyed it. He got a good laugh out of it. And it was a little bit awkward, but roll with it.
Just a cultural,
cultural thing, but at the same time, you knew that you were having success because
there's a trust.
You accepted.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, the man kiss that you've probably heard about. It's more like a whisker rub than a kiss, but you knew that you were accepted more as a personal level.
Hmm. And then I guess, how long did that, I guess, that type of rapport take you to build? in country, was that a couple month type thing, or was that more towards the end of the?
I felt it took about 3 months.
So I guess, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to research is kind of how shifting units in and out, how that can cause some friction. Mm-hmm. And I guess if you're trying to defeat an insurgency, it can alleviate the pressure a little bit and give them some more room to work.
Well, on that topic, when we transitioned out, our 508 then went to secure Kandahar, because that was about the time the Canadians were pulling out. And 2nd ACR came in and took over the AO of Zabul. And you could just see it. It's like they came in, it was all they wanted, was they wanted numbers. You know, they're not supposed to meet with the regimental commander at one point. It was all they wanted to talk about was combat strength and numbers. And I thought it was going to be more of a conversation about the personalities and what you can do and how you can get certain brigade commander to do things. And quite honestly, you didn't give two shits about that.
Hmm. That was the incoming unit after you? And that was 2008, 2009?
That was 2010.
2010.
I was in Afghanistan from August 09 to August 10.
Okay. So that's fairly recent even. I guess, were you able to follow up with that unit at all that went after you?
I don't
really know how anything happened.
Other than, like I said, that that was the first brigade that actually go on their own and didn't need assistance anymore. Mm-hmm. The big thing that the Afghani forces always requested, and I don't know if they'd ever get to the capability to do it themselves, was CAS and medevac. Mm-hmm. You know, it goes back to some of the cultural things. You know, if they had a casualty, they'd want you to fly a helicopter out and bring the body back. But they wouldn't understand that you don't put deceased and wounded on the same bird.
Mm-hmm.
But at times I felt like that in their culture they were more concerned with the dead body than they were with their injured due to the burial rituals and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have quite the same enthusiasm for their casualties.
Yeah.
Wounded, yes, we did, definitely. Mm-hmm. And we got them treated as well.
Yeah. I guess that's, I could understand that from an American standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I guess anything else about the specific area that you'd like to add?
No, I don't think so. Let's see, I think we hit the Romanians.
Mm-hmm.
There was one time where town of Shijoy, we had a VBID come in and killed two of our soldiers at the gate. And my boss went up there, and that was still when the striker unit was there. And we locked the town down, which stopped traffic on Highway 1. I'd say that it lasted about 6 hours, maybe 8, before the word had got up that Highway 1's closed down and got to the president of Afghanistan and trickled back down. That we can't do that, because it was the main thoroughfare.
Mm-hmm. And that caused a little, was that, I guess, higher up with the Afghani government, was that a pretty bad situation?
Oh, yeah.
They were pretty mad.
They weren't so concerned about two American soldiers, but I mean, it'd be like if you closed down one of our interstates.
Yeah. I guess I can understand that from some aspect of their government reasons. Hmm. So was that was your last deployment?
Yeah.
That second one? Okay. I'm just trying to think if there's anything I'd like to ask to kind of get a little more in depth on it. How often were you communicating with the different regional company and platoon leaders? Was that more of a daily or weekly type thing?
Mm-hmm.
And how did their...
Well, it depends. When I was the S3, yes. When I was the SVAT, no. because I was more focused on the brigade staff.
Yeah. I guess, what was the overall... Did you notice any sort of change in, like, the company and tactical level leaders? Their view on how things were going in country? Was there a marked improvement on their standpoint from getting there and leaving? Or was it kind of a up and down, fluctuating type of situation?
I think it was up and down. Some days it'd be great, and some days it'd be frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
When I talked to some of the platoon leaders, and I remember one of them saying, "You know when you're going to have a firefight? When the bread runs out. Because then you're going to have a firefight, they're going to expend their two magazines, and then the walk back's a lot lighter. So when the bread runs out, that's when we walk back."
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that you're going to be firing at anything when you have that firefight.
Yeah, it's just going to be expenditure of extra weight. And that was on the Afghani side?
Yeah. Now, I can tell you about one more thing in Afghanistan. I was tasked to do a 15-6 for a casualty. And this was over on the other side of the country, because I mentioned that the AAB had battalions scattered pretty much all over RC South. And what happened was there was a platoon leader. This is from this FOB to this one was probably about a 30 or 40 minute drive. Started out and it was on a main road. I think it was probably Highway 1. I can't remember exactly. So I think Highway 1, something like this. And you would have to break off and get there. Well, when he was in some sort of little village up here. Actually, I think it went somewhere like that. A river. Lieutenant was responsible for these two FOBs. He had to know how many people's in a platoon?
35.
Roughly. And that's when nobody's on leave, sick,
injured.
35. So how are you going to man two locations with 35 people?
You have to split it. The LTs at one, the platoon sergeants at the other. I guess for division of power, two squad leaders in each division of your heavy weapons. Basically, everything's split down the middle unless there's a reason.
So how many people do you have then at each location?
About 16.
Now, at that time, you can only do convoy with three vehicles or more. So then how many people did you just take away for that convoy? Because you got to still resupply these two.
Assuming you have to have at least two in each vehicle, probably three.
Three. You got to have a gunner, a TC, and a driver at the minimum.
I guess you probably have to man with about a squad each in each FOB and then have the rest of it be able to maneuver.
So you're
going to
put a squad out here, and that's about how many people?
It's 9, 10.
You're going to put 9, you're doing 24-hour security.
It's not easy to do. It's pretty much impossible. So he wasn't really able to move across very often, or?
You have to. The reason what happened was he was doing a resupply mission from the main FOB out to this. It wasn't really a FOB, it was more like an OP. And he only took two vehicles, which is you weren't supposed to do at the time. And as they crossed this riverbed, the back wheel hit an IED, going like this trailer back here, blew it completely over and landed on top. It had a trailer on the back, and they had all their fuel cans full. Fuel cans then spilt all over the Humvee, ignited, and started burning. The platoon leader was about my size, a little bit thinner than I am now, but fair-sized guy.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Humvee landed, it was canted like that because you had the gunner's cupola on top. So he had to crawl out from the TC position to get through the drivers. Now, with the radio pack and everything, it would have been about this wide.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to get through that. He got out. The man in the back, nobody knew what happened to him. The driver was able to get out. The gunner was trapped. I'm not sure if it was the harness that kept him buckled in or if it was his LCE was caught in something. But three guys tried to run up and pull him out. One of them got third-degree burns on his hands and arms. I think the other two got first- or second-degree burns. And they weren't able to get him out. And basically, they had to listen to one of their friends burn to death. And you never forget the look of that lieutenant's face when he's telling me about this, and there's nothing he can do.
Mm-hmm. And even having a third vehicle wouldn't have mattered at that point anyways. Probably.
Well, each vehicle's supposed to have two fire extinguishers. One of them didn't work. It wouldn't have been enough to put the fire out, but it might have been enough to subdue it and long enough to get the person out. That was one of those things where you're talking about command relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Battalion commander looked at this and realized he was assuming risk and assumed it. But from your point of view, this mission is almost unattainable.
Mm-hmm.
You can't provide 24-hour security with a squad. How are you going to do resupplies?
You need more people.
Yeah, and when I was out doing the investigation here, reinforcing the defensive positions, much like you've seen in the videos, and hopefully we've trained you over the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And a goat herder or something walked by, and there was like a grandpa and a couple little kids, and I think I'd just eaten an MRE and gave him a pack of Skittles. Skittles or M&Ms, I don't remember. And they walked about 30 meters, and grandpa took the Skittles and threw them on the ground, and they kept walking.
Right after that happened.
Yeah. Well, it was a couple of weeks, actually, because mm-hmm. by the time they got me out there for the investigation. It's kind of when you're talking about hearts and minds and are we having success.
That's not a very positive. Yeah.
No.
And how long was that? Was that towards the end of the year out there?
Yeah, that was right towards the end.
I guess that probably overall, I guess the entire AO, not a very good morale inducer. It's probably a pretty somber moment.
Yeah, that, and we had a major attack on the battalion headquarters while I was gone too, where we lost some soldiers. And that was in Kandahar. How much more do you got?
I don't really have any questions left. I guess, is there anything you'd want to touch on your time here at UW? Talk about the experience of being a professor of military science here.
I loved it. I don't know if you could see it, but training you guys was the best job I've had in the Army. When I was teaching and trying to share some of the experiences,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure you never heard a lot of the ones we just covered, but if you'd have been in MS4, you probably would have heard some of them.
Yeah, and I do remember a few different, you know, here and there.
Yeah. I thought it was great.
University overall, positive experience with the university.
except for when we couldn't land the helicopters over on the practice field.
That would have been fun.
And we had to coordinate to have somebody watch us train with a telephone.
When was that? Was that a couple years ago?
Oh, we were supposed to pay somebody to watch us train so that if there was an injury, although we had 4 combat lifesavers on site,
this
college student was going to be better support with a cell phone. I think it was another form of taxation, but that's my personal opinion.
Okay. I guess I didn't realize that. I just remember the time where I was laying down and some lady yelled at me and told me I couldn't be there, and I pointed down and go, "My commander's right down there, you can go talk to him," and she just kind of looked and went, and just stormed away, and I was like, yeah, I'm not that naive of a cadet. I don't know what I'm really doing out here as a freshman, but I know you can go talk to him. That's funny. I guess any suggestions, future cadets ever listen to this or cadre, any suggestions coming into an ROTC unit?
One that I'm sure you've heard before, but prepare yourself as best you can, because you never know when you're going to be in a situation like this and how you're going to have to do it. Rely on your subordinates. They'll amaze you given the opportunity. And last but not least, whatever job it is, as you've heard from the last 2 hours, you don't know what you're going to be asked to do. Whatever you got, do it and do it well. And you'll succeed.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
Okay.
Appreciate this.
Well, hopefully it answers some of your questions.
It definitely helped.
I don't know if we got quite in-depth on some of the topics you wanted to or not.
I guess if I have any questions, I could send you a text or an email.
Give me a call.
Sounds good.
I got fat fingers, and it's kind of hard to use that cell phone.
I understand.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
I'll turn this off here.
Okay. Sure.